everyone, it's your host, Allison. I hope you're all having a splendidly scary Halloween weekend. I remembered I had an audio recording of a talk that Jason Blum gave at the Fast Company Innovation Festival 2 years ago, and I thought I should upload that because Jason Blum is amazing. Jason Blum was on a panel called Flipping the Script, How Blumhouse and Amazon Studios Are Rewriting the Rules of Media, and he was joined by Jennifer Saul, who is the head of Amazon Studios. Just a warning, it picks up in the middle of Jennifer's first question, but give it a little bit and it'll start to make sense. The sound quality is so-so because I recorded it on my phone, but it's an interesting talk. I hope you enjoy it and have a happy Halloween.
Clearly questions about the studio system as it existed and had an idea of how to, you know, improve it, or at least a version of it.
He's been way out ahead, always sort of pushing boundaries, you know, for the last many years that I've known him. But for me, it's, you know, coming from traditional, you know, medium like, you know, broadcast networks, it's, you know, we were waiting for, you know, once we sort of were riding the curve ourselves of nobody's really watching these shows, when they're airing, and, you know, our success was being determined by ratings and early morning emails I get at 4:45 in the morning telling me if the show broke through or not, you know, delivering shows in a way that was obviously not the optimal viewing preference became more and more of a burden to carry, and it became harder and harder to feel like you really could wake out of this. I always say, though, that it can come from anywhere. Like, you shouldn't discount networks, you know, cable, streaming. A hit can come out of anywhere, and it happens, and it's as sure as, you know, anything, it will happen again. So we're all striving for hits, and, you know, I'm excited to be at a company, which is why I moved from a job I was loving at NBC Universal. We were, you know, number one, we have a hit show, and This Is Us. It was, we were experiencing the ability to break through and grab a huge audience. But when the knock came on the door to turn my attention to Amazon, it was exciting to me because of those barriers kind of being removed. So the odds didn't feel as stacked against to be able to really break through with great content, which is sort of at the heart of what I love to do. Find great content that I think can break out globally. And so it just feels to me like a more promising pathway toward potential global hits.
For me, it was. I always say it was great. It was definitely Paranormal Activity, and I was really lucky that I was in my mid 30s when Paranormal Activity happened, and I had always loved the movie and TV, but the content business. We didn't call it content then, but I always loved the business. But I never was comfortable in my own in what I was doing. I was an executive. I didn't really like that. I was making independent movies. I didn't really like that. And what I, now this makes me sound much more clever than actually how it happened is Paranormal Activity happened, and I'm looking back on it and saying I wasn't cognizant of it at the time. But what it did was coalesce this idea, which I really loved making independent movies, and I hated making studio movies. I found it really frustrating. But I loved studio distribution, and I really hated independent film distribution. And Paranormal Activity mixed the two things that I love together. It was the ultimate independent movie released by a very, very traditional studio. And why I say I was lucky I was in my mid-30s, because instead of then trying to go make, well, I was encouraged, like, you should make something bigger. And I think if I had been 25, I probably would have done that. But I was like, you know what? I really like this idea of independent movies released by studios. And that's what we built the company around, is making super low-budget, independent, off-the-grid movies that can be weird and different, and having them released by in a very traditional way. And that, so the aha moment wasn't at the time the aha moment, but looking back, that was clearly like a big course corrector for me, where I finally found something I was comfortable doing.
And Jeremy, you kind of touched on this, but I mean, I feel like when anybody talks about Hollywood today, it's all about the challenges of the business and the tough economics. You know, it's no secret that audiences are dwindling, the teenagers who love to play Fortnite and go buy a ticket to a movie. How does that affect you both, to use the word content, when you think about your content, when you think about the projects, you know, you're going to line up on your slate, what kind of pressure does that put on you as you're thinking about what is going to work, what is going to break through?
To me, it all kind of comes down to urgency. If I'm talking to a creative person and they're telling me a story or they have a vision of something they want to do, if I feel like I'm leaning in and there's an urgency even in me to hear more about it, and that I want to go home that night and I have more questions that come up, and want to get back together with that person. It strikes a match of a kind of, you know, desire to you know, really make a point of wanting to know more, being very intentional about it. Many things I hear are great. I'm like, okay, 5 minutes after they left the room, I'm not really thinking about it anymore. My taste isn't going to be the, you know, bar for everything we do, but I can only rely on my internal gut and the guts of my people on my team, who are very diverse and sometimes very different guts than mine, to respond to creativity in a way that feels urgent. And that, to me, is the best way to sort of maximize the chances of breaking through in the world you just described. So when we are, you know, I'll jump right into something that I feel like has those elements. And it doesn't have to be, I don't have to hear it and think, oh, it's for everybody. It shouldn't be for everybody, but it should be for a group of people who you know you think will feel very passionate about it. So that's why my team is diverse, they have diverse points of view, they have the freedom to be able to make those same aggressive moves that I would make in a room. Ordering something, I listen to their passion, even if I don't see it every time. So we're able to tap into what I think those audience bases are in a more urgent way. Just perfectly fine kind of development and shows, it's very difficult. You can't break through, and you don't want to send people spinning wheels. You want to do things that are original and special and have the ambition to grab a certain portion or a larger audience and then really, you know, grab them by the collar and create urgency.
Is that process any different at Amazon than it is at a network?
No, except that I feel more flexibility on the kinds of things that we can do. I always have the same mechanisms for evaluating things that are emotional and intuitive to me, but it's more about the volume, and we can you know, try a lot of different things. And obviously, I'm overseeing a movie slate as well, a theatrical release slate, a direct-to-service slate, the series slate. There's a documentary slate. There's so many different things we can be doing, which is a much bigger playground for me to be in and for my team to be in, and that feels awesome because it's not as restrictive.
What about you, Jason? Well, I mean, everything that Jen said, I would agree with. That's what we, and I do. I really, I treat our executives like our filmmakers. I really empower them. I follow, just like Jen said, sometimes if I don't really see it, but if someone who works in the company is super passionate about it, I'll support them. The one interesting, slightly nuanced difference, and we have two very kind of different businesses between television and movies. And our TV business is traditionally budgeted. Our movie business is all low budgets. And I really love low budget movies for a lot of reasons. The profitability is great, but that is not the main reason. There are actually much more important reasons than that. And one of the biggest reasons is that way that we choose our movies. And the advantage of low budgets, and people wonder why Hollywood movies feel so similar. And one of the reasons they feel so similar is when you're trying to greenlight a movie for $100 million or more, six very bright people get into a room. And by the way, I would do it exactly the same way as if I was at a studio when you're making a $100 million decision, and they have to bring three movies like this movie that were financially successful in the last 5 years called comps. So they come into a room and they say, we should make this movie because it's like these three other movies that all made money recently. We, when you make low-budget movies, can do the exact opposite. You know, it's not because we're geniuses, it's because we're making low-budget movies, so we can take these risks without a ton of capital. So we come into the room on Monday, and if we read something, that we have to love it, clearly, but after that, if it doesn't feel like anything we've seen before, we have the luxury to say yes to that because we're not betting a lot of money. That's exactly what happened with Get Out. We all read Get Out, we all liked it, but we all thought it was the weirdest thing we'd ever read. And when we love it and think it's weird, we jump at it. And that's one of the great things about doing a bunch of movies.
That's an awesome space to be in because it allows for risk taking. And you know, the only way to break through is to try to do things differently. And he's got such a great kind of playground for that. And that would be
I mean, I think it also touches on, you know, I just feel like everyone in Hollywood these days, and they said it for a while, but now they really think, like, there's no middle, there's really no middle. They either have to do what you're doing, or you have to do big IP-driven, tentpole, proven audience project. Do you guys buy that?
Well, I don't buy that for streaming services.
I don't either.
Not at all. The great thing about the streamers, Amazon, you know, and the other streaming services, is it's not that there's no middle. There's I don't think there's really a middle for theatrical movies, but there's a spectacular middle for, you know, huge actors and huge directors are really interested in doing $15 to $50 million movies, and those I think are going to live on streaming.
Right, you have no idea where those things will end up, just like a Get Out. Right? You don't know where the hits will come from, but it allows you to be able to take more risks and find the unicorns in the bunch.
Yeah.
Are you finding more of those filmmakers coming to you for those so-called middle, you know, dramas, not necessarily a huge star, very storytelling based? Do you feel that as a buyer?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we hear all kinds of things. We hear star-driven, limited series, you know, high budget, low budget. I mean, there are really smart producers who are trying to tackle this form in so many different ways. So there's no limit on the kind of things we're hearing. Giant tentpole things. I mean, you take like The Lord of the Rings or Wheel of Time or some of the big world-building genre kinds of series. That's one end of the spectrum. You know, you have like a show like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. You know, there you have, you know, a great, you know, show The Hunt we picked up from Lena Waithe and Little Marvin, which is a, you know, incredible period kind of horror anthology. So there's just so many different ways to do it. It really just is about what is that creative idea and do I feel compelled to want to live in it and hear about it and just sit in it and be with it. Like, that's really what it is, and that can come in 100 different packages.
Mm-hmm. I think that the it's not that the storytelling is so different. It's just where it's being consumed is different.
Right.
You know, the middle of the theatrical movie has disappeared, but the middle, those movies are definitely being made. They're just going to where the audience is, which is at home. You know, they're not that audience. Parents with kids are not going out to the movie theaters when they can have great content delivered to them at home, and that's where the audience is. So the good thing about technology and what's happening now is that you're able to find the audience for whatever you want to make.
And I'm obviously new to the movie side of it. I have not worked in that area in the past, but I really see so many parallels to the, you know, the network model of like getting butts in seats to watch something at 8 o'clock, and it's very difficult to do that. Even more difficult to drive people to a theater. Obviously, the financial stakes of that are higher for families and for people. And it's, you know, like Jason just said, you're delivering the content to them in the way they would prefer to consume it, and that just seems like, you know, this more business sense. So we'll continue with theatrical release plan, and we like having that avenue for creators, and we want the flexibility of maybe moving things into those windows, and obviously awards and those things hold a place in our ecosystem because they'll draw more attention to things, and people will move them up, and we all have a list of intended things we want to watch. It'll move it up in the line if they feel more urgency to see it based on those things. So that avenue will be open, but as he said, this direct-to-service strategy, which he and I are spending a lot of time talking about, is a big one for us. And so it's important.
How do you, I mean, another reality of the business today, I think, is just this arms race for talent. When you have a lot of new players like Apple entering into the business, and you have old players like Disney launching streaming services, everyone is just rapacious to try to gobble up talent. And Netflix, you know, of course, is spending incredible sums of money to get these people. You guys are also lining up amazing talent. What's your pitch to them? I mean, how do you compete in a world where Netflix will just say, sky's the limit, come over here and we'll, you know.
Well, first of all, I think the sky's the limit has changed. There are these huge mega deals. Some of you in the room probably read about them. You know, the Ryan Murphy, the Shonda, the Greg Berlanti, the Obamas. There's a bunch of them. Now, there's a, you know, two hands full. And those deals aren't like, people are not on the corner giving those huge deals to people. Those are here. And then there's tons of talented people working in any kind of, you know, deal in between. So for us, we are, and I can speak for Amazon only, obviously, we are not in the, you know, more is more business. We're in the, you know, curated, building a home for talent, kind of much more of the old sort of studio system model of real partnerships with talent, helping them build their businesses, being creatively, creative partners as well as strategic partners, not in an annoying way, but in a way that supports their vision. And I think there's a place for that in the ecosystem where, you know, there's a big volume play and, you know, you have Apple. And I don't want to speak about other places, but to say that we're creating something that I think stands apart and that will offer this kind of human connected sort of experience to talent where we can all really roll our sleeves up and really amplify something we all love and believe in. And I'm really excited about that.
So it's not go off, we're not giving you, I mean, it's more.
No, and I have writers, I have big, huge A-level technical creators who are elsewhere in deals saying like, when I'm done with this deal, I'm coming to do that because it's not just about the money. It's about like, what does it feel like to do and live and work in these jobs every day? And those creators want that to be a great experience. And so the more you can make them feel like it's going to be a great experience, and you're going to be able to support them, and you're going to have some transparency, and it's going to be, you know, this kind of collective, love around the thing we're trying to accomplish, I think that's really appealing to people in a high volume kind of 500 options.
Yeah, I mean, I can speak directly to that as the seller and the buyer, right? I'm more focused than ever before on because just like you said, I'm going to talk about the financial part of it too because I have a specific feeling about that. But before we even get to that, as sellers and makers of content, I'm in this business not just to do it, and certainly not, you know, if I wanted to just make money, I'd be a banker. So we're in this business not just to tell the stories, but to have the stories be seen. And we talked about some of them are bad, some of them are good, but you want them to have a chance. And it's very frustrating to make something and spend 3 years in it and all this money and have it disappear. So curation is more, all the choices that a consumer has makes curation more and more important. And you want to make sure that whatever network or studio you're with on the movie side is taking care of what you did and understands what you did and understands what you're trying to say with what you did. On the financial side, our model is, again, you're referring specifically to a Netflix model where the buyout takes place, is totally different than Netflix. And I think if artists are not typically motivated by money, first of all. But second of all, if you believe what you're doing is going to be commercial, you are like 100 times better off with us than you are with Netflix. Because
you mean you're going to make filmmakers make money with the success of the film? That's the way
David Gordon Green and Jamie Lee Curtis are going to do a million times better with us than they would have had you get a buyout with them on Halloween, for instance. So if you want to roll the dice and participate in the financial system, not up front, of course it'll be better than that, but if you want to roll the dice on your work and you want to invest in your work and participate in, if the work makes a lot of money, if you participate in it, you're much better off with us if the movie really hits. If you want to kind of play it safe, or maybe if you're doing something that might be a little less commercial, then it's of course better to get paid up front. We work with Netflix too. We've gotten paid up front on things that we've done too, I think. But it really depends on what you're doing, what kind of audience you think it's gonna reach. It's a different choice.
But you're also baked into your system, right? It's just creative freedom. Like you're not a producer, if you say, I'm not an active producer, like you let them go do their thing, and that's part of the appeal.
Yes and no. You can't ask someone to bet on themselves and get paid if it works and not get paid if it doesn't work and force them to do what you want to do. You can't do that. I think that's morally reprehensible. Our directors have final cut. But the result of the process is our process is, again, totally different than Netflix. We make much, much less on the movie side. We are very focused on one specific thing. We do that specific thing really well. So surprisingly or not surprisingly, as soon as you tell the director you're in charge of everything, the phone doesn't stop ringing. What do you think we should do here? What do you think we should do there? So the amount of creative input we have over our movies is much more than a typical studio, way, way much more than Netflix, because the director isn't worried about getting his or her own way. They're going to get their own way, which makes them want our input much
right.
more. Who are we going to cast? Who should we cast? How would that?
It's like psychology.
Yeah,
take
right.
away the bear. You have the right intention.
Exactly. And the process is then much more, it feels much more collaborative. It feels much better. And again, not to sound like a broken record, because if we were doing $100 million movies, we couldn't do that. Again, it's a benefit of both budgets is that we get to. And by the way, it doesn't always work. There are three specific times, which I'll not say when the process backfired. You know, the director really wanted to do this thing. I said it's a huge mistake. It did, you know, I'm not shy. I really got relatively contentious. Ultimately, I have to give in to what the director wanted to do. And on three occasions, it blew up. But since the movie's $5 million, it wasn't the end of the world.
We talk about culture at your companies as well. Jennifer, when you arrived at Amazon, your predecessor, you know, there were sexual harassment allegations. You sort of came in on the heels of that. I think Amazon is known for being, I mean, completely aside from that, I think Amazon is known for being a very particular culture. What has your process been of sort of rebuilding the culture and sort of rebuilding trust there? I read somewhere that your first week on the job, you had a lot of female executives on your couch and you were just kind of listening.
It's true. A few things. When I came in, I had never met my predecessor, and so I just knew what everyone else knows from the media, all the stories, some inside, you know, just working in my business. But I didn't have to spend, you know, much time looking at it. But obviously, I thought about it a lot coming in, and I was so happy when I got it. And I knew, kind of as I was going through my hiring process, that the company was already, you know, the executive search went on for maybe 6 months, maybe longer. So there had already been great work done. There had been great sort of involvement from the really smart, thoughtful executives in Seattle who come down to say, like, no, like, we don't tolerate this. Let me get you all together. So the healing was already well underway. That being said, the group was sort of running around without, you know, they've been a leader. And so to be able to come in and have a leader like myself, which I would pride myself on being someone who's extremely accessible and transparent. I'm not moody. What you see is what you get. This is sort of the person. There's nothing. There's no surprises. And I'm also very positive. And I listen a lot. So I have them all. You know, I have a lot of people wanting to meet me, obviously. But more urgent were these female executives who had you know thoughts and some they had shared already, and some were new things that I was just maybe hearing myself. More personal. And so I liked that because it actually helped women like what they had never experienced, but I liked that they felt they could open up to me, and I feel like it immediately set the stage for the rest of the teams, that we were within a week or two very aligned as, like, not just women, but like people in this business who don't want to tolerate this kind of stuff. Like, I've luckily, knock on something, been in a situation where I've had to tolerate that in a way that I felt was really compromising or limiting to me. That being said, I relate to a lot of other things around the subject, but in my professional life, I hadn't come up against that. So for me, I lead with, you know, positivity. There are great men in our company who are very involved in these efforts. And I came in and signed the Reframe pledge, which is a pledge toward gender parity, both in front and behind the cameras, both in movies and television. Right when I walked in, I told them that I wanted, before I took the job, I had to sign that, and that I also wanted to bring this pilot project I had created at NBC called Female Forward to create, you know, a pipeline for female directors, getting them identified and directing episodes right out of the gate. And so we're doing all of that. So I found nothing but just so much happiness. So, like, I was there to take the lead on this stuff because I love it and it comes out of me and my teams naturally, and so it was good. I don't feel any resistance of any kind.
Mm-hmm. Part of your strategy there too was right to focus more on female storytelling and sort of broaden those sort of projects that Amazon is doing and bringing in more female.
Yeah, it's not just female, like diversity. Like I left NBC with 10 direct reports. 7 of them were diverse and 6 of them were women. So, I mean, I was the minority. So for me, I hired an African-American co-head of television. You know, his partner is an Asian-American. And I'm not going out and checking boxes. There are smart people of every background that work in around us in our business. And I just look for those people intentionally and bring them in, and may the best person, most qualified person, get those jobs. But at the same time, you need to be intentional about it in a world where it's easy to just take the recommendations and kind of come through business as usual pathways. Great people come out of those too. We just have to be thoughtful and aware about who we're hiring, who we're giving opportunities to.
Well, Jason, you got into a little bit of trouble last week over this issue, but you said that the response was that you got all of these submissions from female directors, or female directors have been really approaching you. So has it kind of shed any light on all this talent, or
I misspoke. I want our executives to reflect our audience. So we have over 50% of our executives are female.
And just so it was just a comment about why there aren't more female directors directing your horror films. And you had said,
I misspoke and said there are not. And what I said is I want to work with more. What I meant to say is I would like to work with more. We actually work with a lot of women across the company. Kara Scoville's about to start our Russell Crowe, Roger Ailes miniseries in 2 weeks. She's directing the first and second. We work with a ton of women.
We have to be careful about going after people who are defenders. That he's a friend of this movement and wanting to make this happen. I have screamed and yelled in my office at NBC when I couldn't get female directors. They handed me lists of who were going to assign episodes of shows over the course of the 12, 13 episodes. And I would say, why are there two women on this? Oh, there's not enough, there just aren't enough female directors that are working. There's these, and they're all busy. And so I found myself saying many times, not with an interview, in the middle of an interview, but I've said, like, where are they? Like, what is happening here? Like, why aren't they? And so that's where Female Forward comes out of that. I think that was just a sort of frustration, as I read it, having felt the same way that Jason, was trying to express. But I don't mean to speak for you.
It was just not to parse it. The reason I didn't say anything, of course, is you can't get this out of one words on a tweet, but it's not something new. We have focused and have competed at working with a lot of women across our business. What we're known for is these low-budget horror movies. That's about 30% of what we do. So we have actually worked with a lot of women across what we do, but what I really am focused on, and to your point, is getting women into this. And like I said, I've learned we've tried with Karen Moncrief, we've tried with Catherine Hardwick, and we're gonna continue to make it happen. And she worked. We actually found two in the last week that we're gonna.
There's great female directors working in every genre. It's about providing opportunity for those directors.
And I guess what I want to be careful about, and it's to what Jen said, is I don't want to. I think the notion of I'm doing this on the defensive. I mean, it reminds me, it's the thing that drives me crazy. I don't know, I'm probably gonna get in trouble for saying this too, but when men say, I'm not sexist, I have a daughter, like, that makes me wanna throw up. I can't be sexist and a man and have a daughter. Like, I could literally never, 5 billion men who were sexist and have daughters, starting with the president. It's very important in this context, as opposed to online, to reiterate what Jen said, I'm not doing it because, attack is too strong a word, but I was made fun of or whatever. Doing it, and I have been doing it, it's good for the business, it's the right thing to do, it's right for our audience. And that's why we have been doing it for years. We're continuing to do it. It's why our executives feel good with it. It's not because it's like, I want, it's not a PR thing. It's good for the world, the business, and
the storytelling.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of women and love, I keep seeing the tweet that Jamie Lee Curtis is, the highest grossing, biggest opening weekend for a film with a woman who's, 55 plus, which I think is amazing, and I know all the studios are now, greenlighting older actors.
But we did it, but again, we didn't shine a light on ourselves for it. Insidious 4 stars Lin Shay, who's 60 plus years old, and Insidious 4, we were dinged for that. When we were trying to make it, we asked partners, he said, how are we gonna sell an older woman to, you know, your audience? Insidious is more than Halloween, it's PG-13, so it's really teenagers. And I said, teenagers want scary movies. They're gonna, you know, and I'm really, really proud. I love Lin has been in, we've done 7 movies with her and I love her. And that was a great thing too. No one talked about it, but it didn't just happen for Halloween. And I'm really proud of Halloween too. This is exactly what you said.
Yeah, great. You've talked before about, and you're now covering all these things, it's not just TV, it's news as well, and Jason, you guys also have a TV studio. I feel like this is rare though, most executives in Hollywood are very focused on either one or the other. Is this the future? I mean, is this a new media executive that you're still on TV and there's lots of blurring and you're sort of thinking about those projects?
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of amazing, incredible, I know there's experience that a seasoned film executive could bring to Amazon. I'm obviously not that. But what I do think works in my favor right now, to be able to lead both and what is working, is that we need to view, you know, it's evolving. We're obviously talking about direct to service. We're still talking about talent and storytelling, and that can really be in any medium. And the more people, the deals that you've read that we've made, whether it be Nicole Kidman or Jordan Peele or, you know, Reed Moreno, all these people, they want to work in both. They want to come in and say, could this be a movie? Should this be 6 episodes? Is this a special like event for 2 hours or 3 or 4 hours on as a DTS kind of, you know, the old term, like a mini kind of, you know, an elongated movie, and make an event of that. So there's fluidity in the delivery system, which I love. And so I do think the lines are blurred. I have people come in and talk about, you know, a limited season of a series, and they refer to it as a 13-hour movie, so a 10-hour movie or an 8-hour movie. So it really, the language is all about stories and what is the form those stories should take to be able to be told to the best of their, you know, in the best interest of those stories and that vision. So that's what I like about it a lot. I don't ever feel like, oh, I entered into, you know, scary water here in this movie discussion, because I have really smart people around who will talk to me about the deal making and sort of how that's evolving, and it's been a great education for me. And I don't feel any kind of disadvantage in the company having these sort of people. But I do think it's rare. I mean, maybe in the future. You think it's rare? I think it's the future.
I was just going to say exactly. I don't think it's the future. It is. The line between television and movies is blurrier and blurrier and blurrier. Most of the time we hear about a filmmaker come in and they tell a story, we talk about should this be TV or should it be a movie, because it's hard to, we don't necessarily land on it quickly, which is a sign of exactly what I'm saying. And Jen, having, you know, it's a tribute to Jen and also to Amazon, they're ahead of, they don't even have real history and content creation, and are ahead of everybody else. Clearly, the person running the studio should do both, because I should be having the same conversation with Jen and I with my filmmakers. I may be calm when I say a movie, and the person I'm talking to should be able to say, hey, what about doing this as a series? Here's why it could work better for our service as a series. Currently, right now, there is not a single other person in Hollywood running a studio that you can have that conversation with. As soon as it becomes a TV series, if you're talking to a movie person, they lose it. If you're talking to a television person, if it becomes a movie, they lose it. So you're discouraged from even having a dialogue about it.
You see this changing already at the agencies. I had a few really smart agents call me and say, I'm now working with this really smart television agent, even though I'm a featured, lit agent with a long-established career, because I want to blend. And they have to, otherwise they're having to pull teams together to talk to talent. And coming from the traditional studio, as much as we have the intention every day of like, hey, big movie studio, and Donna and your team, like, let's get together and go out and move talent together. It's just the way it's designed, it's exactly what he said, it just does not intersect. And it's a disservice to the people we have and their deals. And now you see all these deals pulled apart, like, well, my feature stuff's wrapped up here, but my TV stuff, I want it to be with you. And as soon as my feature stuff's done there, I'm gonna pull it into. So you see a lot of that. People want one home. They want to feel like this is the place, these are the projects, and let's have some great partners that we actually like to work with figure out the smart strategy or whatever it is.
I mean, you recently did this with the PERT, and I think this is another example of how a project can span both, where the film came out in the summer, the third PERT, right? And then literally 90 days later, you had this TV show made by the same creative team, but you're gonna wait 2 years, you're smiling.
Well, I didn't bring it up because the Purge, I was going to bring it up, but I guess I
don't
bring it
up. Yeah.
It's just what I'm saying, like that it works because I have a great relationship with Steve Burke, and Steve Burke technically does control movies and TV, but everything else is Universal. But Steve Burke, Jen is hearing pitches from filmmakers in Hollywood. Steve doesn't do that, so he had to intervene to make that happen, and it was great, but it was extremely unusual, and it took a long time to do. And so it plays to exactly my point, that they don't have the creative executives would be Bonnie, or it would have been Bob, or Jeff Schell, and they're very siloed.
Does this pave the way? Because the TV show is doing very well.
Yeah, the TV show.
It will become an Amazon.
And it's Amazon internationally.
Yeah.
It's Amazon internationally, exactly. And the second one was on Hulu domestically.
So Amazon clearly does more than just make TV shows and movies. I mean, when you think of the infinite ways, it's like a marketer's dream, the infinite ways that like a TV show or movie could drive sales of books, merchandise, something at Whole Foods. Can you give any examples of that, or how you're thinking about that? I'm sure, or do you even, is that your purview?
It's not my purview. I mean, this is a gigantic company,
right.
And those divisions are also siloed. But we do, you can intersect. So for me, I love to spend time kind of putting my arms around the greater company. We talk a lot to the Audible team. The books team is very involved with us, obviously. With Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman and others, we have some announcements I'll soon make with big authors. We have a lot of contact with big best-selling authors on Amazon. There's a great cadence with the company with that talent, that literary talent in general, starting with Jeff Bezos on down. So there's access there, and then there's just the incredible technology, there's the merchandising. The options are really endless, so it's been really fun coming in and being able to put things into development that have that intersection and starting to really build and refine bridges to those other parts of the company.
What are the more unusual, because obviously you think of books and DVDs, are there any unusual examples of
except the Heidi Klum, Tim Gunn, whatever the next iteration is of a fashion competition show that is in development and holds great promise for how it can coexist in the merchandising area. I announced something with Blake Lively. She wants to do a scripted show that she has great ambition for that show to have a component that ties in with merchandising. So these are new relationships with me building with those parts of the company, so we're in the middle of doing that. But those are some examples, and there are more. I mean, we also invest in some great, comic book companies and different. So those people are all coming to my office now too. So there's sort of a spirit of collaboration that's starting to find its way through the company, and I'm really excited for great things to come out of it.
I'm just going to throw a futuristic question at you both. Will network television be around in 10 years?
People ask me that. They asked me that. I spoke at USC on Saturday. I come from network television. I have a huge affection for it, a giant beating heart for it. I would say if Amazon dropped it and then available, you would find me in my office at NBC Universal right now. We can grab a gigantic audience, even with declining linear ratings. The way the shows are being consumed and how success is being evaluated and monetized is changing everything we sit here. So yes, it's not a streaming play, but it's still a huge business. And when I look at the actual numbers of who shows up to a hit show on a network or a football game or This Is Us, and being part of my career of things like that broke through Glee, Modern Family, This Is Us, like you see the power of a giant hit like that, And so you can't discount networks. Will it continue to become more difficult? Will they be forced to evolve their model? Will they be forced to, you know, figure out other ways, bigger ways, wider ways of monetizing and defining success beyond the linear view? Yes, they're doing all of that. So I don't discount. Mm-hmm. I think they said I don't throw dirt on the grave. Like, I just believe that it can come from anywhere. Watch. You'll be surprised. You won't know what will happen. What are you thinking?
I'm not to sit with Jeff. I'm not even remotely qualified. Sitting next to this person here, I'm not going to.
What about the theatrical release? I mean, Netflix thinks really we don't need it. Sparingly, so things can, you know, be considered for Oscars, but they're very adamant, at least until this point, that we don't need that. Do you think that will ever go away, theatrical release?
No, I don't. It'll go there just like theater never goes away. It's not going to go away, but it's going to change. I think that there's going to be. I think we're definitely going to play with windowing. I think that you're going to continue to see Disney now, Disney Fox, theatrically released movies with long windows, tentpole movies for a long time to come, and the other studios with big tentpole, huge, expensive movies. I would be surprised if our movies have those windows in the same way, although I haven't seen that for a long time, and they still are. But I think it will change. But people are going to go sit in a big theater with lots of other people and watch stuff on a big screen for, I think, a long, long time to come.
I would agree with that, and I would take that back to the network. So, like, people want to gather and watch something together, and that can come. That's really what's at the heart of believing that. Don't discount network or any other device, you know, any other delivery system. But the movie, you know, division, I do think the windows will shrink, mm-hmm. but I think theatrical release will definitely be a big part of our strategy, and it's not just, you know, for the awards consideration, but more importantly, it's for, you know, there are a lot of talented creators out there who really love and feel passionately about that, delivering that experience with their vision, and we want to be able to support that.
I imagine that comes up quickly in conversations with some of these filmmakers, that they're coming to you because they know they can get a theatrical release.
Well, for us, because I think we've had a track of supporting prestige, you know, smaller movies with that strategy, and that strategy will continue, but it will evolve. I've recently restructured the movie team to provide different avenues toward different kinds of movies, mm-hmm. but that doesn't, you know, mean that quality is going to go down or that we're going to close the door on those prestigious pathways. But there are a lot of really smart producers out there who come in and they're all not like, has to be theatrical, you know, there's been like a humbling of the whole business given the volume, and I think people are open to being creative about how, you know, we deliver these shows and movies.
Jason, I just want to produce every year, I constantly hear your name. Doing what you're doing. I mean, you've kind of shown people this formula. You went out, you built this company, you can do things cheaply, you have a built-in audience. It seems on paper not easy, but when you're showing people how to do this, but no one else is doing it, why not?
I'd like to say if it were easy, everyone would be.
Yeah. Maybe that's why.
Thank you. You know, it's funny. I had a conversation with a producer like 3 days ago, and it's a longer answer to your question, which I'm not going to give because it's boring and too inside to show off. Jamie Lee Curtis calls it business show off business. But I think if you had to boil it down to one fundamental thing, it's that Hollywood is just addicted to money. And it's just too tempting. And this is across the board. This is directors, these are artists, management, agents, lawyers, everyone, producers. It's just very hard. Our business, again, movies and TV are different, but on the movie side, we don't do expensive movies. When someone comes in and says, I have the next Transformers, we don't do it. And it is just really, really hard fundamentally for people, especially when you're successful, it's like you have a hit. So obviously the next thing to do is something more expensive. It's so built into the system. I was saying to this producer I spoke to, like, if you're a director and you do a Sundance movie and you sit with your team of managers and agents, like, we're going to get you a $10 million movie, we're going to get you a $20 million, a $30 million, a big series. That is, to me, just so silly. You know, we should get you a great story, whatever it is. And by the way, I think that the bigger the budget is, the more compromises that you have to make, the less the work is really yours. There are five, except Jim Cameron and Spielberg. There are 10 people in Hollywood who get to do whatever they want at any price. But for the rest of us, I always talk about low budgets because I fundamentally believe that they allow for better storytelling. But I think that's low. But it's not sexist. You know, our offices are in Koreatown next to a homeless healthcare center. It's not glamorous. Hollywood is maybe it's addicted to money, but maybe it's glamour. I think about storytelling over glamour, you know, and I think that's kind of. I guess I think it's easier said than done. I think low budgets can be a hobby, or like between the big budget, we'll do a low budget. But to just do low budget, that's not what I came to Hollywood for. I think people would think on all sides of this.
And you make singles with the home run. So it's such a smart strategy. It's true. People are like intoxicated by more and more and more, and you have to have restraint. So even in the battle to make overall deals in the world of those deals we just talked about, you know, you have to be willing to say, I am passionate about this person. I think they can be very successful with us. This is the culture. This is what we're going to offer. This is what it's going to feel like and look like. And this is sort of the limit of where I can go. I'm going to go for that financially. But we're all going to be kind of in it together, you know, participating in it successful, all of that. And, you know, some people who are influenced by, they're just trying to get the financial brass ring, will walk away from that deal, and others will be like, I kind of like this, even though the finance of it might feel more restrained than some of our competitors.
There are so many agents and lawyers who represent people who call and say, you know, my clients work for scale. They say, show me one week if my client will never work for scale. It's literally the stupidest thing you could ever do. The best movies, forget our movies, you know, the best, Woody Allen pays as that paid everyone for scale, 45 movies. Like, so you're not gonna put them in a Woody Allen movie, you know, and that's the answer to your question. Part of it.
We're out of time, but thank you so much, Jason and Jennifer.